Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Well, we stopped last time in chapter 3 of Ezra, where the people were so happy about the laying of the foundations of the temple. Well, the real question comes, if they were so excited about the laying of the foundations, why is there such a gap between 538, when Cyrus issued the decree for the Jews to return home and build the temple, and the second temple was not finished until 516? Why all those intervening years? Well, that's what chapter 4 is going to deal with. We're going to be dealing with chapter 4 through 6, which finishes his first part of the book of Ezra, before we get into the personal ministry of Ezra in chapter 7, as he returns, apparently, with another deputation of exiles. Now, here in chapter 4, there seems to be a parenthesis. Now, if you don't see that, there's really going to be a historical problem, because there are kings mentioned that deal with a large period of the Persian history. It seems that the author, not following Western sense of history, picks up in verse 6 through verse 23 with a parenthesis. He's starting out to talk about the problems in the temple not being built. And then he kind of says, well, maybe I'll just survey the whole period and show all the problems through all these different Persian kings that dealt with the rebuilding, not only the temple, but with the walls of Jerusalem. And as you know, Nehemiah is going to pick up with the rebuilding of the walls. So here we have a historical parenthesis on all the problems dealing with the resettling of the city of Jerusalem. Notice it mentions, now when the enemies... Now, the problem with the enemies is that Ezra says that the reason that the temple was not built for all these years is because of the Sanballat, the governor of Samaria, Tobiath, a governor of Ammon, and other cities around there and nations around there were jealous of the Jews and tried to stop them. But Haggai says that it's Jewish apathy that led to this. And so here's two different views on why it took so long. Notice it says the enemies of Benjamin and Judah. It's always been confusing to me about the northern 10 tribes and the southern 2. Well, remember, there's 13 tribes after we split Joseph into Ephraim and Manasseh. We count the Levites with the northern tribes. And so the southern 2 are Benjamin, Judah, and very early Simeon was incorporated into Judah. Okay? Heard the people of the exile were building a temple to the Lord. That's the capitalized Lord. So it's Yahweh, the covenant name for God. Remember last time in chapter 3:11, we mentioned the covenant name Yahweh and the covenant verb Hesed, translated mercy in King James, loving kindness in New American Standard. Those two special covenant verbs. Now, they approached Zerubbabel and the heads of the fathers in the household, that would be the elders, and said to them, let us build with you, for we... like you, seek your God. And we have been sacrificing to him since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, who brought us up, up here. Now, Esarhaddon was an Assyrian ruler from 681 to 669. And he was part of this deportation involved in this northern 10 tribe area. And what they're saying is, we're Yahwehist also. Now, to some extent, that was true. We know there were some people left in the land when Assyria deported the majority of the population, and they imported people from Babylon and Media and Elam. Well, they kind of intermarried. And we learn some of the problems here from 2 Kings 17, 24 and following. There was a problem. God judged them, and there was wild animals. They got a Jewish priest to come and taught them the law. But it was a kind of an eclectic religion. We learn something of this eclecticism from the Elephantine Papyri on the Jewish mercenaries and the island on the first cataract of the Nile, written in Aramaic, the same historical period, of how eclectic they were. And they even built a temple there to do sacrifices. And this was the problem, this amalgamation, this eclecticism that brought other gods into the worship of Yahweh, and the returning Jews would not accept them. Well, it really made them mad, and from then on they were enemies. But Zerubbabel, now he is the Davidic seed, apparently one of the grandsons of Jehoiachin, and Joshua, now he's the grandson of the high priest when Jerusalem fell, And the rest of the heads of the father's house of Israel said to them, you have nothing in common with us in building a house to our God, but we ourselves will together build to the Lord God of Israel as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, has commanded us. So they rebuffed, and from then on there's problems. Look at verse 4. Then the people of the land. Now this word has a variety of meanings. Before the exile, it refers to landed nobility, the rich, powerful men who owned land. After the exile, it refers to the people of the land, the poorest people, the common people, and that's how it's used in the New Testament. Here in this verse, it seems to refer to the Samaritans, the people who had been in the land longer than these returning Jews, okay? Discouraged the people, they weakened their hands instead of strengthening their hands of Judah and frightened them from building, okay? And hired counselors against them. This is obviously either they bribed someone at court or maybe some kind of lawyer system was in vogue, but they had some advocates, okay, at court to frustrate their counsel all the days of King Cyrus and Cyrus II of Persia until the reign of Darius. Now, here is that long period. Cyrus II is the first Medo-Persian emperor over this large empire we call Persia. Now, Darius II is much later. We've got Cambyses in between, and so he's much later down. Let's see. Cyrus would be... He took over the Medo-Persian empire... captured Babylon about 538, 539, right in there close. And then Darius doesn't start until 519 through 486 B.C. So it's that long period. Now, this is not the Darius of the book of Daniel, okay? This is Darius the first Hastrapes. Now, okay, now in verse 6, the princess starts. Now, in the reign of Ahasuerus. Now, we know him. Ahasuerus is the Hebrew form of his name, and we think this is the husband of Esther, okay? He is called in Greek Xerxes the First, and he's called in Persian, I'm going to spell it because it's got four consonants right in a row, K-H-S-H-A-Y-A-R-S-H-A, okay? And so he goes by all three of those names. In the beginning of his reign, they wrote an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem. Now, Artaxerxes is after Darius the First, and so you can tell we're way down in history. We're making a large historical jump. And so in this parenthesis from 6 to 23, we're going to be talking about the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem, where in 1 through 5 we were talking about the rebuilding of the temple. Now don't be confused here. Okay? In the days of Artaxerxes, Bishlam, Mithrathah, and Tabeel, which means God is good, and the rest of their colleagues wrote to Artaxerxes, king of Persia, and the text of the letter, look at your Bible in verse 7, mine has, was written in Aramaic and translated from Aramaic. Now, the New English Bible says it was read aloud in Aramaic. Now, I want you to jump down to verse 18 where it says, another document, and by the way, I think there are three documents here. There's one in verse 6, there's one in verse 7, there's one in verse 8. I believe there's three documents instead of two. Look at verse 18. The document you had sent has been translated and read before us. Now, why translated? This is Aramaic. The first Aramaic section of Ezra begins here in chapter 6, verse 8, and chapter 4, verse 8, excuse me, and continues to 6:18. Then it picks up again in this royal or imperial Aramaic in chapter 7, verse 12, and runs through 7:26. Now, Aramaic is a Semitic language. It was used during the Assyrian Empire. It was kept in Babylon as the official language of law. Well, the Persians kept Aramaic, but the Persians did not all speak Aramaic. It was kind of the way of unifying the realm, something of what English is in modern India, because there's so many dialects. That was the way this was. So it had to be translated for the king, apparently, who did not speak Aramaic but spoke Persian. Now, notice in verse 8. Rehum the commander and Shimbashai the scribe. Now we've learned from Herodias, chapter 3, section 128, that the Persians appointed an official scribe for every satrap. And though that scribe was under that satrap, he was directly related to the king. It was kind of a way of keeping tabs on these satraps and their power. And that seems to be what this man is. Now, he wrote a letter against Jerusalem to King Artaxerxes as follows. And here's the text of the letter. Then wrote Rehum, the commander, and Shimshai, the scribe, And the rest of their colleagues, and the judges, and the lesser officials, and the secretaries. Now, all those translations of English words are very dubious because we're not sure what they mean. But in the latter part of verse 9, it begins to describe men with a geographical location. Now, if you look at verse 10, it shows you that what we're doing, the Samaritans are identifying themselves from the geographical locations from which they were exiled under this Assyrian king. Now, my Bible has it O-S-N-A-P-P-A-R. But I know him better as Ashurbanipal, an Assyrian king that reigned from 669 to 627. Ashurbanipal. Now, he deported and settled in the city of Samaria. Now, Samaria was the capital of the northern 10 tribes. This deportation was started by the Hittites and continued even to the Persian period, okay? And then we have a copy of this letter to Xerxes. Notice it mentions in verse 12 the finishing of the walls. And so we're obviously in the period of Nehemiah, not the period, this early period of Ezra. Notice in verse 13 their first charge. If you let them build this, they're going to rebel and not pay you any taxes. Now that's in verse 12. And their second charge is down here in verse 16. If you let them build this city and build these walls up, they've revolted in the past. And if you check your records, you'll find it, they're saying. And if you let them, they'll take over the whole satrapy known as beyond the river, which the river is the Euphrates, the Syria and Palestine. So they're threatened loss of taxation and a renewed rebellion with the possibility of losing this whole territory. So obviously they're really saying something the king of Persia will perk up and listen to. Okay? Then verse 17. Then the king sent an answer to Rehum, the commander, and to Shimshai, the scribe, and to the rest of their colleagues who live in Samaria, and the rest of the province beyond the river. That's the technical name for this Syria and Palestine under Persian. Peace. And now, the document which you sent us has been translated and read before me, and a decree has been issued by me, and a search has been made, and it has been discovered the city has risen up against the kings in the past. And this must refer to something under Hezekiah, and the other rebellions that Judah was involved in. It possibly gone back to King David and Solomon, their vast conquest. We're just not sure. Notice it mentions here the mighty kings in verse 20 that ruled over Jerusalem. That's got to be David and Solomon. And then verse 23. Then as soon as the copy of King Xerxes' document was read before Rehum and Shimshai, the scribe, and their colleagues, they went in haste to Jerusalem to the Jews and stopped them by force of arms. Now, wasn't this was embarrassing? Here came their enemies, the Samaritans, with soldiers and stopped the rebuilding of these walls. Now, some documents say, because of Nehemiah 1:3, that they burned the walls that were already in place. So they just didn't stop them. They destroyed the work they'd already done. And that probably is true from Nehemiah 1:3. Now, Nehemiah 1:3 either refers to what the Samaritans did here in this verse, or the fact that some of the destruction under Nebuchadnezzar II of Babylon had never been repaired, and we can't be real dogmatic. And verse 24, we must see that verse 24 relates back to verse 5. If you miss that, this chapter will be a real historical problem. Okay? That mentions Darius, the reign of Darius in verse 24. That's Darius the first. Hastrapes 522 through 486. Now in chapter 5. Then the prophets Haggai and Zechariah, son of Iddo. Now Haggai preached about the need for the rebuilding of the temple around 519. Zechariah also emphasized that around 520. Now here he's called son of Iddo. In Zechariah 1:1, he's called son of Berechiah, son of Iddo. And here's a good example. The Hebrew word son can mean grandson. Notice it says, a prophesied to the Jews who were in Judea and Jerusalem in the name of the Lord, the God of Israel, who was over them. Now this seems to me they're encouraging the Jews, but it's God who's going to do it. This is a very familiar kind of way. You might want to see Philippians 2, 12 and 13. Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. But it's God that works in you to will and to do His good pleasure. It's always God's initiative, but man's response. Here's a good example. Now, in this, we're going to talk about the resumption of the building of the temple. Not the walls. Now, the walls are chapter 4, verses 6 through 23. But in chapter 5, we're reverting back historically now to the reign of Darius the first, and we're going to be dealing with the completion of the second temple, okay? Now, this same hassle over trying to stop them came up again. At that time, Tattenai, the governor, see in verse 3? Now, there are several possibilities here. We've learned from documents, Persian documents, that he was not the satrap. A man named U-S-H-T-A-N-N-U, was the satrap. But apparently he was an official helper, okay? And maybe he was accounting to the king for this very aspect of rebuilding this second temple. But he hears all the problems. He comes and says, now, who gave you orders to do this? And who? What's your name? Just like an official, isn't it? And they said, well, King Cyrus is the one. So they kind of go through a little ditty here about Cyrus told us to do it, and we're just doing what he told us. They don't bring up why it delayed so long, but they do say Cyrus told us. So this man writes a letter, and he's going to ask them to search the records and see if this is true. And that's what chapter 5 is all about. I want to mention a couple of things to you. Notice in verse 11, it mentions the God of heaven and earth. Now, that's the full phrase mentioned back in chapter 1, verse 2. Isn't it unusual as little struggling group of Jews still claims that their God is the creator and ruler of heaven and earth? Now, some have said, well, they're just trying to play on Persian sympathy for Ahura Mazda, who was also called the God of heaven and earth. That doesn't sound like a bunch of radical monotheistic Jews to me. I think they believed God was the only creator of heaven and earth, and they didn't believe anything about Ahura Mazda. Now, notice it mentions in verse 14 these utensils from the temple in Babylon. Now, this would be the temple of Nabu, N-A-B-U, or Marduk, M-A-R-D-U-K, the chief gods of Babylon. Well, it was embarrassing for the Jews to have the utensils in the temple of Yahweh and the temple of Marduk. Now, I mentioned in verse 14 the Sheshbazar, who we found in chapter 1, verse 8. And I discussed with you earlier the difficult problem of the relationship between Sheshbazar and Zerubbabel. Albright thinks that Sheshbazar is simply Zerubbabel's uncle. I think, whether he's the uncle or not, I'm not sure, but I think he was governor first and Zerubbabel was governor next. That seems to be the solve the problem for me. Some think they're the same guy with two different names, but I don't think it'll fit. Okay? Now notice in verse 16 we have this strange phrase, then Sheshbazar laid the foundations of the house of God. Well, it's attributed to Zerubbabel earlier. So, what's the deal? Well, I think it's not with the men being identified, but this word laid the foundations. This is a Hebrew word that has wide meanings. You might want to see in 2 Chronicles 24, 12 and following, it means to repair something. It's used in chapter 3, verse 6 for Zerubbabel starting the temple. But in Haggai 2:18, I think it's the real key. I think that Sheshbazar laid the foundations, which means cleared the rubble off, found the original foundation stones for Solomon's temple, and began the work. But I think Zerubbabel finished it, apparently. And that's the connection here. Now, in chapter 6, we're beginning this discussion about searching for this document of Cyrus II. Then King Darius I issued a decree, and a search was made of the archives where the treasures were stored in Babylon, and in Ecbatana in the fortress. Now, we learn from Herodotus Xenophon in his Cyropedia 8:622 that Cyrus lived in Babylon in the winter, Susa in the spring, and Ecbatana in the summer. We also learn that Cyrus II stayed his first year in Ecbatana. It's a Median capital, more north than the other two. And this where this document was found, okay? Which is in the province of Media, a scroll was found that was written at the following memorandum. Now, remember that this is probably a memorandum that included all the peoples returning home, not just the Jews. And so we're going to quote just a part of it. In the first year of Cyrus, about 538, Cyrus II, the king, issued a decree. Now, we have the Aramaic of this decree in chapter 6 and a Hebrew form in chapter 1. Then a lot of fight if they're the same one. Apparently, the Hebrew was what was read to the exiles by the public proclaimers. But the official Aramaic is what recorded in chapter 6. And that the Jews did not have a copy of this, or they could have stopped the Samaritan accusations real quick. So apparently, they had a verbal edict, but not a written copy of it. All right? Now, notice it mentions here about the temple in Jerusalem. It's rebuilt to a certain size, verse 3. Its height will be 60 cubits and its width 60 cubits. Now, there's two possibilities here. Number one, Cyrus II didn't want him to go crazy and build too big of a house, so this 60 cubits, be it, if the cubit's 18 inches, you can catch the size. Now, and so it may be a limit on the treasury funds that'll be available. But it's probable that from 1 Kings 6:2, that they're trying to build it on the same standard as Solomon's temple. But there seems to be a problem in the numbers here. For although one of the dimensions was 60, the other is not. And so I think we have a copyist error here in the numbers. Notice in verse 4 it says, three layers of huge stones and one layer of timber. Now the huge stones are probably not as big as Solomon's temple, but big enough they have to be rolled instead of carried. Now the one layer of wood, from archaeological finds, we learned this was the common way of supporting cement walls, maybe against earthquakes or whatever, but it was a common practice, we've learned, and so it fits the history right here. Let me skip down to the end of verse 6 where it says, keep away from there. But the king wrote back and said, you Samaritans, and all, just keep away from the Jews. Let them do. They have the right to do it, and the treasury is going to pay for it, which meant their taxation. That was a real blow to them. Not only could the Jews finish it, but the Samaritans and the Ammonites are going to have to pay for it. Oh, croak. Well, this seems to be a technical term that their accusation against the Jews has been rejected, and they have to stay away from the whole area and not bother with them. Okay? And that seems to be what we're dealing with here. Let me go down to verse 9, where it also mentions about the sacrifices. Now, many of these Persian decrees seem to be very Jewish. Well, I'm sure they had Jewish counselors to talk to them about what was needed and how you phrase the name of God and what kind of technical structure the temple needed to be. So here we have the idea of young bulls, rams, lambs for burnt offerings for the God of heaven. Well, it exactly fits the Old Testament criteria for sacrifice. Exodus 29, 38 and following, Leviticus 2, 1, and Numbers 28, 1 and following. And so it fit because I'm sure the Jews corroborated on these texts. Verse 10. That they may offer acceptable sacrifice to the God of heaven and pray for the life of the king and his sons. Now, that last week when I quoted the Cyrus cylinder, that's what Cyrus wanted. He wanted all these gods put back in the very same place where they used to be, and the sacrifices and temples be restored exactly so the gods wouldn't be mad and they would bless Cyrus. Now, we learn from historical records that Darius I, much like Cyrus II, was real conscious of the temple being put back together exactly right, and the exact place, and with the exact form, and the exact sacrifices of all these different gods. So it really fits in the historicity of its day. Now, verse 11, and I issue a decree that any man who violates this edict, a timber shall be drawn from his house. Now, you look at your Bible in verse 11, chapter 6, 11, and he be impaled on it. Now, there's three possibilities, impaled, crucified, are from the Apocrypha book of 1 Ezra 6:32, hanged, okay? Now, all of these were capital punishment and a public display. I really think crucifixion may be a real possibility because in Deuteronomy 21:23 is a public curse from God to be publicly killed, and that may be a reference here. We can see it also in Daniel chapter 2, verse 5, and Daniel 3, verse 29. Now, chapter 6, verse 12. And may the God who caused his name to dwell there. That is very much like the book of Deuteronomy. It's obvious the Jews are corroborating on this official document. This is the very phrase where God says, no, I'm not going to be worshipped in Gilgal. I'm not going to be worshipped in Shechem. I'm not going to be, worshipped in all those other places. I'm going to be worshipped in Jerusalem. And that's this little phrase, caused his name to dwell there, which later meant, of course, the temple. Now, let me skip down to the end of verse 14 where these kings are mentioned again. Cyrus II, Darius I, and Artaxerxes I. Now, Artaxerxes I is under Ezra Nehemiah, the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem. Darius I is Haggai, Zechariah, and this first part of Ezra under Zerubbabel and Sheshbazzar, which is the rebuilding of the temple. The temple will be finished in 516. That's what verse 15 is talking about. The finishing of the second temple. Okay? Now, from 538, issuing the decree, to the finishing of the second temple in 516, the period we've dealt with here, although it's been that historical parenthesis that covered a much bigger period. Now, verse 16. Then the sons of Israel, the priests, the Levites, and the rest of the exiles celebrated the dedication of the house of God with great joy. This word dedication, you know it as the word Hanukkah, which came to be the Jewish holiday later on in history when Judas Maccabeus got the temple back from Antiochus IV Epiphanes and instituted this middle December festival of lights that we call Hanukkah, but the Hebrew word means the dedication. And they offer the dedication. Look at the 1,000 bulls, 200 rams, 400 lambs. You say, what? That's elaborate. If you look at Solomon's, which they're trying to parallel Solomon's temple, the way they constructed it, the size, the terms, and all of that, the day they begin it and everything, it's very meager, very, very meager. Notice the book of Moses is mentioned in verse 18. Now, we learn in the book of Moses that the priests are going to take turns. But it was David who issued and made the 24 divisions of the Levite priest and when they would serve. So it's in the law of Moses, but David divided it up. And that's what verse 18 is all about. And in verse 21, notice that a large group is going to be included in this first Passover. The temple has just been finished. They're going to have a dedication, and the Passover comes very quickly. And they're going to let other people join in. Now, this is very important to balance the exclusivism that seems to be present in not letting the Samaritans participate. They wouldn't let the Samaritans participate because they were still idolaters to a large extent. But anybody who had purified themselves or separated themselves from the impurity of the nations of the land could join them. Now, some say this refers to the Jews who were left in exile and left in the land and were not exile. Some say it refers to the resident aliens, but I really think what it's talking about is proselytes. If there was any foreigner there who had been circumcised, who had baptized himself, and was ready to be a part of a sacrifice, was welcome. Now, this is a good balance to this radical exclusivism. God has always loved the nations and wanted to be a part. But there was some criteria in the Old Testament, as there are criteria in the New. Now, in verse 22, there is a real problem in the word the king of Assyria. It doesn't seem to fit historically unless it's another name for the king of Persia. So it's either a copyist error. It's very early because it's in the Septuagint. It's either a copyist error or we don't know why it's there. Well, next time we're going to deal the personal life of Ezra in chapters 7 and 8. I've enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.